This edition of Culture with Robert Bound was first broadcast on the 5th of November 2012 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to the 56th edition of Culture with me, Robert Bound. This week we've got our scattergun out again. It's a cultural blunderbuss. It's a weapon of mass instruction, a musket of multidisciplinary art and interest set to stun. Here is what's in our barrel. Coming up over the next hour, there have been more TV ads during this election campaign in the US than at any other time in history, so we went to meet some of the voices behind them.
Financially, it carries me through 2 years. So I will do more work in September and October than I will the whole rest of the year.
We'll also hear about Argentine record label Zizek's first European release.
We never really planned on making a real label or starting a real label, and 4 years later having released 20 albums and toured all around the world. But it was just kind of like, you know, we were inspired by the music and we wanted to get that out to everybody else.
We'll sit down for a coffee with filmmaker Kerry Levi to discover how he and artist Ralph Steadman have joined forces. Not on screen, but in print. It's all about birds.
You get birds like the Bishop's Oh-Oh, and you think, well, that's a made-up bird. And it isn't. It's real. It's quite interesting, you know, that people don't quite know where to look. And let's face it, these things are extinct, so who's to say they didn't exist?
Plus, we'll enjoy a Midori House session from the Mastertons, we'll pop into some artists' open houses in Madrid, and soak up a minute of sound in the Amazon rainforest. Joy, oh joy. That's all coming up right here on Culture with me, Robert Bound, on Monocle 24. And to kick things off, Texan husband and wife duo The Mastertons stopped by Midori House recently for a Midori House session. And here they are with Crash Test.
I wanna ride with you, travel through space and time with you. I wanna ride with you, take a swim with you. To the ocean blue with you, I wanna dive with you. I just gotta know. So come on, let's go. Don't wanna wait for you, baby. There's not enough time. I don't care if we don't make it. I just wanna try. I wanna crash test. We're going out of our heads. I'm gonna crawl straight up the walls with you. I wanna lose my mind with you. Wanna fly with you straight up into the western sky with you. I'm so high with you. I just gotta know. So come on, let's go. Don't wanna wait for you, baby. There's not enough time. I don't care if we don't make it. I just wanna try. I wanna crash test. I wanna crash test. I wanna crash test. I wanna crash test.
Thank you.
Those were the sunny sounds of the Mastersons from their Midori House session, performing tracks from their new record, Birds Fly South. And we'll hear more of that later on in the show. And you'll also hear them shooting the breeze with Andrew Muller, too. Now, think of a number. 665 million? No, it's not this week's lottery payout. It's the estimated amount of money that's been spent up till now on TV advertisements in the US supporting Barack Obama or Mitt Romney. And it's a record. And here on The Culture Show, we were interested in the industry behind these productions. And despite the fact it's growing, there's still only a handful of people whose voices are used to push these campaign messages on screen. As the election draws to a close this week, we dispatched Sarah Richards to meet some of the voiceover artists behind the ads that have been inundating America.
More of the same. He's demanding tax hikes. Over 2 million small businesses will get higher taxes.
Right now, in some parts of America, there are so many political ads on the airwaves. It's almost as if you can hear the voices in your sleep.
A vice president Americans can count on.
A three-letter word. Jobs. J-O-B-S.
Exactly what Mitt Romney wants to do. To pay for a $250,000 tax break for multimillionaires.
Obama says he'll move us forward. But where's he taken us so far? America's worst economic...
Republicans are criticizing Mitt Romney for his attacks on 47% of the American
people. The middle class, who move our country forward, work hard.
Telling us who did what, who didn't do what, sometimes even explaining why. But there's one thing the vast majority of people don't realize when they hear these ads. It's that the people narrating them are probably doing it in their closets.
This is my little booth. And it's cold in here because it's a closet. There's no heat.
Catherine Clavana is what's called a voiceover talent. She's perched on a stool in her Washington, D.C. home's 3-foot-wide closet. She's converted it into a recording booth. This is it. This is where the secret sauce of many political ads gets made.
Like here, we'll try this one. In a tough economy, we need a governor who's on our side. But Tom Emmer sides with corporations and CEOs and opposes...
Clavana is one of a small group of people, probably no more than a couple of dozen, who narrates most of the big political ads in the U.S. Clavana has voiced ads for politicians like President Barack Obama. Right now, voiceover talents like her are working nonstop, sometimes recording late into the night.
Financially, it carries me through 2 years. You know, we'll do more work towards the end of an even year, right? We're in 2012. So I will do more work in September and October than I will the whole rest of the year. And then like a little squirrel, I take my acorns and I put them away and I sort of dole them out and get through 2013. And then I'll be in 2014 and ready to sort of replenish my stores.
For Clavana, those acorns come courtesy of Democratic candidates. Clavana doesn't voice ads for Republicans. Voiceover talents pretty much commit to voicing for one party. Sheldon Smith says there's a reason for that.
Political advertising goes in the door with zero credibility.
With spending already out of...
Smith voices ads for Republicans. His voice is a legend in the business.
$2 million to California to collect ants in Africa.
He's been doing this since 1974, back when audio equipment was so big and expensive, you had to go to a production studio to record a voiceover. Smith says voicing ads for competing politicians diminishes the ad's credibility, even if people rarely realize it's the same person.
Because something is going to be wrong. And with political advertising, you don't want anything to be wrong. People do not like political advertising. And if you ask anybody, they'll tell you they don't like it.
But no matter how much voiceover talents try to keep things straight, problems can still pop up. Especially now that so many advocacy groups are funding issue ads. A few years ago, Harlan Hogan was voicing ads for a Chicago politician. He won't say who, but calls him John Jones.
So I got a call from my agent here in Chicago, and she said, oh, you have a commercial tomorrow, 9 o'clock at a studio downtown, and it's for the Chicago Federation of Teachers, which is a union. I said, okay, fine. She hands me the script as I'm walking in the booth. I look at the script and it says, "Have you heard the terrible things John Jones is saying about blah, 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 blah?" And I'm thinking, heard them? I said them.
Needless to say, Hogan didn't end up doing the ad for the union. But he's far from the only one who gets overwhelmed during election campaigns.
I did 32 campaigns in 2010 in that many different states. And when you consider there are 50, that's most of them.
That's Lance Luman. He's well known in the political industry for his voice in Democratic commercials.
A mayor who says he's trying his best, but on taxes, the facts say Greg Ballard isn't what he seems.
Yeah. We're standing in a small studio in Luman's basement. The ceiling is only a couple of inches above our heads. Books and VHS tapes line the walls. Luman's wife, Kristen, she also does voiceovers, is with us. There are many ways to voice so-called politicals, but Lance Luman says that when it comes to negative ads, one particular tone is very popular. He plays a slightly different version of the ad he's just played to demonstrate.
A mayor who says he's trying his best, but on taxes, the facts say Greg Ballard isn't what he seems. He campaigned against taxes, but Ballard quietly raised 140 taxes, rates, and fees, and spent all the money too. Indianapolis, we can do
better. It's more incredulous in that reading, say, than the first one. The first one, the one right before it, had a little more. He's such a, you know, we know he's a bad guy. Whereas this is like, he's not a bad guy, but we can't believe he did that. Can you believe that? So that's, incredulous is big in politicals. Because, you know, then you're not being the bad guy by saying negative things about it. You're just not believing he would do that. Can you believe that?
Who uses loopholes to pay a lower tax rate?
When it's all over, Luman will be looking forward to the holidays. And then it'll start all over again in 2014 for the midterm congressional elections. For Monocle in Baltimore, I'm Sarah Richards.
He's just not looking out for us. American
Federation. You're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound. Next, we're hopping on a plane to Buenos Aires. Stay tuned.
As more and more governments demand cuts in public spending, design in healthcare is viewed more often than not as an unaffordable luxury. But design-savvy Denmark, not surprisingly, recognizes the curative potential of good design.
If you should look at the outcome for the patients, you should really think about the design, about the inclusion of nature, about the inclusion of organic materials, because it really lifts the patients.
Monocle Films drops in on a hospice that feels more like a home. Broadcasting now on monocle.com.
Welcome back to Culture with me, Robert Bound, where we're now heading to South America. This week sees the European launch of the much-vaunted Argentinian compilation Future Sounds of Buenos Aires on Cartel. The disc is a sampler of the weird and wonderful sounds of Argentina-based label ZZK, founded 6 years ago. It's been making a name for itself, taking traditional Latin American sounds such as cumbia and folklore and mixing them with electronica. Our man in Buenos Aires, Ed Stocker, met the people behind the music to talk about the imprint's first ever European release and its renowned Zizek Club Nights.
Argentina and Buenos Aires is a very musical country, and beyond the typical cliche of tango, really there's all sorts of sounds and all sorts of genres that Argentines are really good at. Really the big music here in Argentina is more cumbia and more folkloric music, then tango is kind of like for a very reserved part of sophisticated capital society.
Grant Dahl is the 36-year-old co-owner of ZZK Records. Born in Texas, he moved to Buenos Aires in 2004, lured by the books of Jorge Luis Borges and the sounds of Astor Piazzolla. But far away from the traditional side of the capital, Dahl found himself immersed in a flourishing contemporary music scene that absorbed influences from all over the continent. Every expat needs a visionary idea, and Dahl soon launched a cultural events website, which meant he came into contact with a host of artists and producers. They were mixing up local sounds with everything from ragga and dub to techno. Launching a club night seemed like a logical idea.
Well, about a year later, we realized that there was such a wealth of music coming out of the club and of the producers and the artists that we were working with that it would be a shame not to make an album and start a label and see what happened. We'd never really planned on making a real label or starting a real label, and 4 years later, having released 20 albums and toured all around the world. But it was just kind of like, you know, we were inspired by the music and we wanted to get that out to everybody else and have people listen to it.
Dahl was lucky enough to arrive in Argentina as a scene was emerging, but smart enough to realize that it could travel a long way if properly marketed. Here were artists who grew up listening to international dance music as well as more traditional sounds, an internet generation who wanted to mix their inspirations together.
My background is electronic music and rock also, but I started traveling around 2005 from Peru and Bolivia, and I really got inspired by the music from Los Andes, the folklore from there. The spirit of the music there is unique.
Chancha Villacircuito, aka Pedro Canale, is one of the artists featured on the Future Sounds of Buenos Aires. His name comes from the journey he used to make around the city limits of BA. Chancha, meaning pig, is a slang name for the train, and the Villacircuito is a circular trip around the periphery.
My music is a mix between everything I like as a sound. It can be a mix between different kinds of music influences and sounds that I heard from the nature, the streets. I think my music reflects this spirit of mixing everything together.
ZZK's sound may have grown to embrace a wide range of genres, but when it first started, it was all about cumbia, without doubt the most popular pan-Latin sound of the moment. In Argentina, cumbia has carried a lot of social and political stigma, and it's meant it has often been dismissed by Buenos Aires residents as tropical music of the poor people. Mariano de la Aguila, a music journalist with Clarín newspaper, explains.
There is still prejudice against cumbia because traditionally it belongs to the villas, with these slums around the cities. And the cumbia villera starts there and tells the story of drugs and violence, but almost fun for these people. So the media still have a crooked look of the music. They think there is not good music or is cheap. And then the CISEC parties come to change this perception of cumbia.
ZZK has come a long way in the last 6 years, initially touring the States and appearing at South by Southwest Festival in Austin, Texas, not long after the imprint was founded. Since then, concerts have taken the collective everywhere from the south of Argentina to the north of Colombia via Europe and Russia. Chancha Villacircuito remembers his first experience of playing overseas with a wry smile. It provided inspiration for his track Prima, which appears on the Future Sounds compilation.
Prima is a song with a strong influence from dub and also with a type of cumbia that comes from Central America more than South America. Prima is also referenced to my first gig abroad in New York, where I had many problems with the computer and with the DJ program that started to change the pitch. It started to go slow and then go faster. And in the track Prima, the tempo plays with the same idea from this mistake. So Prima is a way to look what happened in a funny way.
Indeed, it's this originality that keeps ZZK pushing those boundaries, about as far away from tango cliches as you can get. For Monaco and Buenos Aires, I'm Ed Stocker.
For those just joining us, you're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24. Still to come in part two, we'll sit down with our country rock couple, the Mastersons, and enjoy some more of their Midori House session. We'll have a coffee with filmmaker Kerry Levi to hear about his and Ralph Steadman's new book on extinct birds. We'll peek behind the doors of the studios of some of Madrid's creative community, and we'll soak up a minute of sound in the Amazon rainforest. Lots more then, dear listener, to absorb in your brain here on Culture with me, Robert Bound, on Monocle 24. Another track from the Mastersons' Midori House session now. This, from the new album Birds Fly South, recorded here at Midori House last week, is Money.
How much money would make you happy? Would a pile so happy sure worry away? If you work hard is the price you pay. Living your life on layaway. If you had it in your pocket, would it be your friend? Would you hold it all tight? Trap. Only 18 and you're just a rat, caught up in the game that they make you play. Fine princess, you're losing the race. So you work hard, but the things you gain never amount to anything. If you had it in your pocket, would it make you happy? But you're so unhappy, didn't make you happy.
And that was the Mastersons with Money. And after their session, Andrew Miller sat down with them to put the record straight on that record.
I think that both Chris and I are kind of attracted to characters that are sort of down and out or kind of having a hard time. I don't know, for some reason it just seems to be inspiring to write about.
No, I mean, I don't know if it's living in New York and, you know life is... You know, where life can be a struggle, and a beautiful struggle, but I think, you know, there's a lot of broken characters on the record. They tend to find redemption, though. It's, you know, there's sort of a happy ending. It's just not quite like the storybooks.
You live in New York, despite hailing from Texas. What was the reason for that decision? Were you trying to get away from, I guess, a more traditional country-ish music background in Texas, or was it for reasons of convenience?
We wanted to live in a blue state, first and foremost. no, Texas is amazing, and you know, the musical heritage is, you know, made us the musicians we both are. But I just had visited New York from, you know, I was maybe 17 the first time I went, and I knew that I wanted to live there at some point. And I never cared how long, you know, maybe I'll only be there a year, maybe I'll never get out alive. And I'm not in the outcomes business. I just had to get there. And we're about 5 years in now.
Yeah, it's been a great muse.
Although you don't actually spend a great deal of time there between doing this and your other jobs playing with other people's bands.
That's true. We played 107 shows last year in 2011 with Steve Earle. And I've been out most of this year promoting our record and then playing with Steve in any time in between. So, yeah, we don't get home very much anymore.
Now, as you alluded to there, you are members of Steve Earle's Dukes and Duchesses. I mean, do you hope that you'll still be able to keep doing both?
Absolutely.
I certainly do, yeah. I mean, I enjoy both. It's almost two different hats or two different skill sets. I mean, I love playing guitar behind another songwriter. You know, I love being a slave to the song, so to speak. But I love writing songs and touring this record. So I hope to, you know, as time goes on, be able to do both.
What about the making of your own record? Because obviously making a record is a fairly intense and passionate experience. Is it difficult to keep a separation, I guess, between personal and professional lives? Or does
it is
separation? What is that?
So how do you referee those disputes then?
When we made the record, we had an engineer and producer friend of ours, Steve Christensen, who worked on Steve's Towns record, and George Reef on bass, and our drummer, Falcon Valdez. And so we figured between the two of us and the three of them that there'd be an odd number, so at least someone could break the tie. So, you know, we kind of just had those guys are like family to us, and we've worked on a bunch of records together, so I figured that would be a good way to go.
Yeah, I mean, I think the in that separation, I mean, the greater the level of intimacy, the lower the level of professionalism. So, yeah, we don't treat each other as kind as we would treat our band members or employees sometimes, you know.
Does that spill over into the writing of the songs as well? Because there must be presumably temptations in that context to get a little bit passive aggressive about things.
Oh,
do either of you ever read each other's lyrics and go, "Hang on, that's not fair"?
Well, I don't know about just personally attacking the other person in the song as we're writing it, but I can remember
not
the
yet.
First time. Not yet. The first time we sat down to write, I can remember Chris saying, "Well, that line is rather pedestrian." And oof. I just got so mad that we got into this huge fight, and then he stormed out of the house, and I had to go driving around the neighborhood to try to find him. So, you know, but we've written many songs since then, and, you know, we just have to sometimes take a break to cool off.
It takes a little more work, but then again, it's a little more rewarding. I mean, we're out on this tour together. And that's, you know, a lot of times when you're out in a band or as a solo artist, you're spending a lot of time away from the ones you love. And we ride around together, and we, you know, we meet new people and eat good food. We eat well, and we, you know, it really softens the miles, you know, getting to travel together.
That was husband and wife combo Eleanor Whitmore and Chris Masterson, a.k.a. The Mastersons, talking there with Andrew Miller. And you're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound. Extinct Boyds is the name of a book that's just come out by illustrator Ralph Steadman and filmmaker Kerry Levi, who's probably best known for his film Gorillas Go Bananas, a documentary on the cartoon-based band invented by Blur frontman Damon Albarn. The idea for the book came when Levy was curating a show called Ghosts of Gone Birds, where he asked renowned artists to submit a piece of art dedicated to an extinct bird of their choice. Ralph Steadman, who was one of the contributors, started inventing his own imaginary birds, and so the two artists turned their ideas into a book full of these real and imaginary creatures. Amy Zayed sat down with Kerry Levi last week.
Well, I asked Ralph to create an extinct bird for a show that I was putting together on bird extinction, and Ralph created one bird, and then he created another, then he created another, and then suddenly we had about 136 of them. I don't know what happened, but Bird seemed to really get into his blood. And we never set out to make a book or anything. We just found ourselves on this amazing journey together, which we were really enjoying each other's company. And then Ralph sort of deviated from creating actual authentic extinct birds and started inventing birds. So suddenly there were birds like the southeastern tellychat or the lesser blotted bitwing or the once bitten or the nasty turn. And it just went on and on. And it's just been the most extraordinary year of my life working with him, really.
These words all sound like being imaginary birds, like little imaginary friends that you have when you're 2 years old.
People get confused because you get birds like the bishop's o-o. And you think, well, that's a made-up bird. And it isn't. It's real. So what is the real defining line between real and non-real? It's quite interesting, you know, that people don't quite know where to look. And let's face it, these things are extinct, so who's to say they didn't exist? We've ended up creating this place called Toadstool Island, where all the extinct birds go to live. Being a filmmaker, I'm always hoarding information, and I kept all of our emails, I kept all of our conversations on Skype and things, and used all of this as reference to tell the tale of A, how these birds came into being, and B, tell the story of our relationship.
I mean, when I've heard of it, what struck me and what fascinated me is the mythological thing about birds. Because, like, you know, my favourite two symbols of all time is the albatross and the phoenix. Because the albatross stands for freedom and also a bit of solitude, while the phoenix is the ever-reviving, coming out of the ashes. Is it the same thing? Is it? Do they tell kind of little characteristic stories about us, these birds?
They certainly tell stories, and I'm afraid most of the birds in this book usually tell tales that are really terrible tales of what man's done to the natural world. So you look at half these birds, you know, the great auk, the last pair, one was beaten to death because it was believed to be a witch. And that's only in the late 19th century. So, you know, there are extraordinary things we've done to nature. And this book tells that. Even though it is, I hope people will find it funny, entertaining, amusing, it's also informative. And it also hopefully presents the whole subject of extinction, which is a dour and serious subject, in a different light and will appeal to a different audience, a populist audience, who may not normally know about what kind of plight the world and birds are in.
Now, if I buy this book, I mean, what exactly is expecting us?
Well, you've got all of Ralph's birds. On every right-hand page, you've got a bird, the illustration of it. And on the left-hand side, you've got a description of the bird, how it disappeared from our world. And then also you have another separate column, which is our ongoing relationship between Ralph and myself over the last year and a half of the creation of this, what turned out to be a book. Every bird in this book has a story, has a tale to tell. It's like the Needless Smut. The Needless Smut is my favourite bird, and Ralph's too. That came about because we were talking one day about a programme we'd seen on television the night before. And I said, yeah, the problem with it was there was too much needless smut in it. And Ralph suddenly went, the needless smut, it needs to exist. And by 6 o'clock that evening, it existed.
Would you mind reading some of that?
So this is the opening poem from the book, and this one is one that describes exactly what we went through and explains who we are and what the book is all about. A commentator and an illustrator got together as creators, not just of any old potatoes, but became extinct boid perpetrators. Though thinking they were bird haters, they discovered they were bird raters. They loathed the job, but never mind, they had not realised they were so kind. To recreate all of these birds required a mass of art and reams of words. Finally, it would disprove a lie that none of these birds again would fly. You'll also discover that in the book, a lot of these birds take on characters of their own on Toadstool Island. Like the Needless Smut is the mayor of the island. There's also only one human on the island at the moment, and that's a guy called the Man Who Hated Bird Shit.
Why is he on there?
Because he just is. He's sort of like the tax collector of the island. So they don't like him, but everyone pays their tax in guano. Guano is bird poo. But a lot of them, because they don't really like him, give him their deposits on his head. So every time he looks up, he gets one in the eye.
That was Kerry Levi talking to Amy Zayed, and his new book, Extinct Boids, which he's co-published with Ralph Steadman, is out now. And you are tuned in to Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24 to Spain next.
Section D is Monocle 24's show about design. We explore the people and products, the buildings and businesses, the signs and cities that make life better. Each week we bring to life the relationship we have with the things that we live with.
Actually, one of my favourite objects
is my motorcycle. I love going by motorcycle. I have this Royal Enfield, a classic English motorcycle from the 50s, but it's exactly as it was in the 50s, and I love the shape, the sound of the engine. I love really how it fits in my life.
We sit down with a cast of characters and chew through the issues at stake in the design world today, across manufacturing, craft, fashion, architecture, and graphics.
That's Section D with Hugo MacDonald, premiering every Tuesday at 1900 hours UK time, right here on Monocle 24.
Welcome back to Culture with me, Robert Bounds. Now, Madrid's art community recently flung open its doors to the public, inviting curious eyes into the studios in the inaugural initiative aptly named Open Studio. The four-day event is yet another example of how the city's artists are banding together to confront the challenges of rising taxes and a dwindling customer base. An artist's studio is much more intimate space than a gallery, and our man in Madrid, Liam Aldous, thought it would be the perfect opportunity to survey the state of Madrid's contemporary art scene with artists in their natural habitats. Arriving unannounced and armed only with a microphone and a couple of questions, this is what happens when you gatecrash an artist's studio.
I'm Marlon de Azambuja, a Brazilian artist in Madrid, where I have lived and worked for 7 years.
Okay, so what is the thing you're working on today that we're going to talk about?
Well, this artwork that I have on show is called Metasquemas. Metasquemas is a set of drawings and photography, and what I do is take a walk around the city and take photos of certain elements I encounter on the ground. Sewers, metal plates, the access points for electricity cables, and water pipes. And then on these photographs, I attempt to draw lines connecting these elements, creating types of geometric or architectonic drawings, which attempt to generate another way to view our urban spaces. In fact, many of my friends that come across my work while walking around the city say, "Hey, I can't stop looking at your work." And this is because it establishes a system of connecting everyday objects that stays with you.
I leave Marlon to attend to the influx of guests, and now I'm heading through the Chueca district to Ramon Mateo's studio, where I'm hoping to see one of his audiovisual projects.
I was working in the border between Mexico and United States for 2 years or something like that. I produce 4 pieces, talking about different ways, different things about the situation, the matters, and the problem between the border, the people, the society, and politics. And one of the pieces was called Juarez Sound System. It was a performance in which I invite to the people from Ciudad Juarez to sing a song of no reciprocal love, because I think it's a very good metaphor of the relationship that they have with the other side of the border, with the United States. So they sing this song.
Yeah, and in the video you can see them actually singing towards the border, no? Looking over the barbed wire fence, singing to no one. That's amazing.
No, they were singing to the country, to the other side, only to the other side, because it's really, really close. I think that because all the city, it's happened in different places of Mexico, but in Ciudad Juarez is very, very hard. All the city is looking to the other side, not to the Mexico, sino to the other country. No, so I think it's a good idea to put just in front of the border and to talk to sing to them. No?
With the Ciudad Juarez singer's song of unrequited love still ringing in my ears, I'm now heading downtown to visit Colombian artist Antonio Franco. A polemic of sorts, I have heard that his work is often laced with humorous social commentary.
The work is, the name is Jai Joplin, or Art Could Be Good. And this work is a video, stop motion, make to with a photo frame. I drawing Jai Joplin is a very important man in the world of the art, and this man, this very strong man, and a very big person in the world of the art talk about your contact and your very big artist. And the end of the video said, "I am frightened, help, help." For me, it's very interesting because this man, I like to see this man in a crash, when he crack. And I like, in the world of the art, I like when the structure is broken. It's my interest.
It's getting dark now, and I'm heading over to the nearby Condaduka neighborhood to drop in on the urban art collective Boa Mistura. This group of five young, determined artists shot to fame early this year after a transformative project in a Sao Paulo favela. As I approach their corner studio, it's no wonder then that at 9 o'clock on a Friday night, it's still a bustling hive of activity.
I'm Juan from Boa Mistura Crew. We are a collective of urban artists. We have also Pablo, Ruben, Javi, and another Pablo. We are five guys. We've grown up in the same neighborhood, and now we have an art collective. One of the guys is architecture, the other is civil engineer. We have a graphic designer, one photographer and video maker, and an illustrator. So, and we develop our work between urban art and some design, also interventions on public spaces, and we like to work on the street. You have a bigger power of communication, and you can be in touch with all the people, and you have the whole city in order to communicate something.
And you have some of the pictures of some of your projects, your big projects on the walls here, one from a favela in Brazil.
Yeah, this is one of the last projects we made. It was in Brasilandia. It was a favela from Sao Paulo in Brazil, as you said. And it was so cool because we were making workshops with people, and we get people involved, the same neighbors, in order to change their own spaces. So it was only with painting. We were just a teeny spark that start a new process of change, and was completely awesome in order we could work together with them.
So what are you working on at the moment?
At the moment, what we have, one of our biggest projects is called Crossroads, and it's participative urban art in poor areas, and trying to take the art as a process of change. So using art to improve their own areas and our neighborhoods. Because what we think is that what you have around, in a way, is what you feel in your heart. So if you can change this and you can see something more beauty and you see colors, and that's going to affect you inside your heart, and that's going to make you feel in another way. And our discourse is trying to make something more happy and more positive.
And that was Juan from the Boa Mistura crew, ending Liam Aldous's report there from Open Studio in Madrid. And you're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound. It's only Monocle 24. Staying on the theme of art now, let's move to the United States. In downtrodden Oakland, California, something rather special is happening. A city is coming together around art, prompting a broad urban revitalization. The Oakland Art Murmur was founded in 2006 as an open night at the city's galleries, and today is the core of a monthly street party that attracts thousands of people from across the Bay Area. Monocle correspondent Alistair G met with Danielle Fox, the head of Art Murmur, to find out how the event is reshaping the town.
The Oakland Art Murmur is definitely not a quiet murmur anymore. Tell me about that. I mean, how has it grown so big?
It's just grown a little bit every year since it started in 2005. As the galleries started having openings on one evening, people started coming out to the galleries. As more people came out to the galleries, more galleries opened in the district. As there were more galleries, there was a larger audience. As the audience grew, performers and street vendors started coming out and populating the sidewalks and the streets in the surrounding area. Then more people started coming who might not even have been that interested in the galleries, but enjoyed the live music and crafts and things on the street. So a street festival has grown up around the Oakland Art Murmur Art Walk. Street festivals called Oakland First Fridays, and they both happen on the first Friday of every month and activate the uptown neighborhood.
How did it come about? Where did you get the idea from?
Well, I wasn't actually part of the association when it began in 2005, but it's common in many cities for galleries to have, you know, a single night of the evening when they all open. And in San Francisco, it's the first Thursday of every month. So as there started to be a few galleries in Oakland, enough, you know, I think it was only five or six when it started, but they decided together they could make an event. And so they decided to open up on the first Friday of every month.
And how many people are you attracting now on these Fridays?
About a year ago, the estimates were 7,000 to 10,000. And in the last 2 months, I've heard the numbers 15,000 and 20,000 tossed around.
Wow. And how many galleries are participating?
We have 20 galleries and 10 mixed-use art venues. Mixed-use art venues include cafes, bars, and little boutique retail shops that also do rotating art exhibits.
I guess this is quite an interesting development in the context of Oakland's history. I mean, Oakland has is famous for sort of a history of civil unrest, for inequality, for being quite economically downtrodden, and yet it's seeing this blossoming. Why is this happening now?
Well, I mean, honestly, the city has been investing in this neighborhood for many years, but Oakland has kind of had this story of it always being about to become and never quite getting there. And in the last year or two, it really feels like it's finally arriving, taking on a kind of life and personality of its own. The arts are critical. I mean, I can't take all of the credit as if it's only because of Oakland Art Murmur that the whole city has blossomed. It's coming, you know, the city's investing, developers have invested, but the art, the restaurants and the arts have really been the core of the cultural renaissance here. And it's really the reason that a lot of people are moving to this neighborhood, so that we have a new residential base that we never had before. And people come to me all the time and say, I came to Oakland Art Murmur and I loved it so much, that's why I decided to move into this neighborhood. And so that's really helped to revitalize things. We've also benefited a lot from what's happened in San Francisco in the last 10 years, which is that it's become incredibly expensive. The tech boom and all of the tech money has just made San Francisco very, very expensive to both live in. And as tech companies took over a lot of the warehouse spaces south of Market where artists used to live and have their studios, the artists started moving over to Oakland. And I don't know the numbers, but I'm told that Oakland has the highest per capita rate of artists. Like the highest percentage of our population is artists compared to any other city in the country.
It's striking that the art has been leading this Oakland revitalization. When you think of attempts to regenerate cities, you think of housing projects or, you know, massive government investments in, at least in Europe, you know, in sort of in redesigning the city center or something. Yet in Oakland, it has been art.
I don't think it's that uncommon to see the art and the galleries leading the way. If you look at the galleries in New York City, for example, you know, Soho was just, you know, a run down, very poor warehouse district. And then artists started moving into some of the spaces because it was inexpensive. And then the galleries went where the artists were. And then the shops and the retail went. And then, of course, the prices rise and they move over to Chelsea. And then the same thing happens in Chelsea. And now it's the meatpacking district in the Lower East Side. So it's not the first time that art and galleries have revitalized a neighborhood. I think it's actually a very common pattern.
And what is the mechanism here? I mean, why is art such a draw and such and so helpful in regenerating cities?
I think part of it's that artists aren't afraid to go to marginal neighborhoods. And so when you have galleries and studios in an area that other people might be hesitant to go to, the artists are used to living a little more on the edge. And so they will go to those neighborhoods. And as they come and start to populate it and inhabit it, then it starts to feel a little more exciting and activated and welcoming to other audiences who then fall in behind. You know, so I think part of it's just kind of a comfort with that kind of edgy urban zone, you know, when things are just beginning.
Do you have a sense of how much art is being sold at the Art Murmur and also the broader economic impact of the event?
It's something I'm still trying to actually collect data on. I've put out a survey recently to the galleries, and I know that for the surrounding, I know that the indirect impact is very great. I know that there are businesses in this neighborhood which used to just be empty storefronts and is filling rapidly in. With even just the small businesses, like whether it's restaurants or burrito shops, they can make enough money just on that one night a month that they can ride through the rest of the month.
And that was Danielle Fox talking with Alistair G about the Oakland Art Murmur. We're fast approaching the end of the show here, but don't switch off your set just yet. Time to squeeze in one of our 60-second soundscapes, and this time we're off to the Amazon. Here's what happened when Georgina Godwin paused in the Brazilian rainforest for exactly a minute. That was a minute of sound from the Amazon rainforest, and that's just about all we have time for this week. Next week, we'll hear what happened when I went to Siberia, for which we should warn you now that it is a report that does contain the consumption of vodka. Don't forget, if we've delighted or disturbed you and you need to let it out, you can always email Katie or me. I'm at rb@monocle.com. Producer Katie can be contacted at kb@monocle.com. You've been listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound. Thanks to the old girl, Katie, once again, and let's not forget her sidekick, an expert sound scientist, Holly Fisher. Time for one final song this week from the Midori House session. This is the Mastersons with One Word More. Thank you for tuning in.
Now one word more. Could we just sit here for a little while, staring at the floor? 'Cause we might not get to the bottom of anything at all. Oh no, so could we just sit here? Let it go, it's hard, I know, to let it go. If you wanna be the one who's right, well, all right then, and I'll take the blame, 'cause I'm too tired of fighting. You've heard all my lines before. Now one word more, one word more, now one word. One word more, 'cause I might go off half-cocked and then you show me to the door. Seems I just never say what I mean to say. I'm so sorry, that's all. And I hope you know, I hope you know. Let's let it go. If you wanna be the one who's right, well, all right then, and I'll take the blame, 'cause I'm too tired of fighting you.